President Rouhani says that his country has not seen any goodwill gesture from the new U.S. administration yet. Britain says it's steadfast in its unwavering support for the security of Saudi Arabia despite its war on Yemen. And the World Health Organization is warning of a false sense of security in Europe. It says most of the nations on that continent are still vulnerable despite a fall in COVID cases. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Eruz Zentafi. Good to have you with us. Starting off with Iran president saying that the country still has not seen any goodwill gesture from the Biden administration. Hassan Rouhani says Washington's words have changed, but we need to see how it'll compensate for the past and wrong policies in action. The president labeled the former U.S. president as a terrorist who was removed from office and disgraced. Rouhani urged the new U.S. administration to abandon Trump's failed and wrong approach. He said if the new U.S. government is honest, it should immediately change course and move on the right path. Author and commentator John Stippling believes that the administration of President Joe Biden is not likely to show any gesture of goodwill toward Iran.
You know, Biden just asked for the extradition of Julian Assange. He recognized Juan Guaido as president of Venezuela. He already brought troops into Syria. His appointments to foreign policy are all liberal interventionist hawks. People like Victoria Nuland are back in government. This is the woman who orchestrated the coup in Ukraine, whose husband Robert Kagan is a neocon zealot. You know, Samantha Power is part of the administration. The advice he's getting, the people he has surrounded himself with, are not going to be prone to making goodwill gestures to Iran. Goodwill? No, I don't think you're going to see that. That's one thing I just don't think you're going to see. I mean, Iran is the villain of the moment, and they serve a useful purpose in that role. It's not based on anything real. Iran has been demonized for 50 years, so to expect that to change seems a bit unrealistic. It's just not going to. Certainly, it's not going to come from Joe Biden.
Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has kicked off new military drills in the southwestern province of Khuzestan. The maneuvers, codenamed the Great Prophet 16, involve different units, including the infantry, special forces, and airborne troopers. Commandos, armored divisions, artillery, and missile and drone units have also participated. The commander of the IRGC's ground force says that the exercise is aimed at assessing the latest achievements and capabilities of the elite force, as well as its operational strength and combat and defense equipment. Brigadier General Mohammad Fakhpour says Iran's armed forces are prepared to counter any foreign threat and protect the country's security. Time for the news review section. Stay with us. Welcome to the news review. Britain saying that London is steadfast in its unwavering support for Saudi Arabia's security as the Arab monarchy continues deadly war in Yemen. The UK Foreign Secretary denounced the recent drone strikes a Yemen's Ansar movement on an airport in the kingdom's Asir province. Dominic Raab urged the movement to stop such attacks. He, however, stopped short of calling on Riyadh to halt its deadly strikes, which have killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians since March 2015. People in Yemen say that Saudi Arabia uses its air force to launch air raids on their country, vowing to continue retaliatory operations until Riyadh stops those attacks. The UK, a major weapons supplier to Saudi Arabia, has been defying calls both at home and from the international community to stop its arms sales to Riyadh. Now, Let's see what our commentators think about this issue. So joining me will be Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law with Princeton University, joining us out of Yale Kavak, and also Jahangir Mohammed, Director of the Center for Muslim Affairs in Manchester. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Richard first. Is this a joke? Because which country is under attack? It's Yemeni people that are under attack, and the Britain is concerned about Saudi's security?
Well, that's the cover story for being concerned about maintaining arms sales that have been very profitable for the UK and given it a kind of diplomatic presence in the region that it might not otherwise have. 40% of the UK arms sales between 2010 and 2019 were to Saudi Arabia. It's the major customer. And I think it has to be put down to that kind of economically driven diplomacy, plus the anti-Iran ideological solidarity with Saudi Arabia.
But now over to Manchester. But Jahangir, the Yemenis, did they have any other options apart from these retaliatory attacks that they have been launching? They are attacked, and they have to defend themselves. And that's, you know, in the absence of any practical help on the part of international organizations or the international community.
Well, I think, obviously, the Saudis are bombing from the skies and attacking the people of Yemen. Which has caused mass famine in the country, and people have a right to resist that that attack. And of course, the Western governments have been aiding and abetting that with arms sales to Saudi Arabia. So, I think it's obvious that there's external interference in Yemen. And the people have a right to choose their own government, to choose how they elect that government, and not to have one imposed on them from outside. So the Yemeni people are really defending their own sovereignty, and the Saudi Arabia is doing everything to subvert that. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the number one arms purchaser in the world, and you would think this small country, it's waging a world war on somebody who's buying that many arms. You wonder at times why they're buying so many arms from the United States, which is the biggest arms seller in the world, and of course Britain is in the top five as well. I think it's number two or number three, I don't remember. Right. So obviously that plays a part, but ever since Lawrence of Arabia, the famous British spy, helped to create some of the puppet regimes in the world, there's a consistent policy from the United Kingdom in propping up families in that region. So I think it's not a surprise that the United Kingdom is supporting the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. And supporting it in Yemen, because it sees a independent government in Yemen as a threat to the Saudi royal family.
Yeah. Richard, if you remember, there was this bill or some kind of ratification that Westminster calling in the government to stop or somehow curb this arms sale to Saudi Arabia, and also given the fact that it's a known fact that those arms provided by the U.S. and the U.K. and also France, they're being used to take mostly civilian lives in Yemen. So is there any justification for this, apart from, as you said, just caring about not the people's lives, it's only material gains that the UK is trying to gain?
There certainly doesn't seem to be a justification. There, unfortunately, are not clear international law prohibitions on supplying weaponry to foreign governments, and so in a sense it's a matter of diplomatic discretion on the part of the UK. It's surprising in light of the fact that the Biden administration, which has done some questionable things in the region that you discussed earlier, but one constructive thing it did was to stop the shipment of offensive weaponry to Saudi Arabia in the hope of securing a peace negotiation in Yemen. And this really breaks that the UK refusal to join with the US in this way really breaks the momentum that might have led even the Saudis to think that they're pursuing a lost cause.
Mm-hmm. And Jahangir, one last question for you. I mean, when Western countries like the US and the UK, we also have France and maybe some others, they are selling weapons, and among them to Saudis, and you know how they're being used in Yemen. So, I mean, they're talking about human rights, and is human lives the right to live a normal life, not part of human rights? They're always boasting of and preaching, and in practice, this is what they're doing.
Well, of course, it's just total hypocrisy. They sell weapons to some of the worst human rights abusers in the world, and to different armed groups. So, you know, they actually fuel a lot of the conflict in the world instead of looking for peaceful resolutions to the problem. And as long as you have people arming different sides, then what happens is that bloodshed continues. Of course, when they talk about human rights, they really only mean their own people in the West and Europe. They're not really showing that much concern for the rest of humanity, and I think this is the real issue here, and the Muslim world really has to stop their interference and to resolve all their problems in the region into a peaceful settlement, because you can't stop people fighting and resisting for the right to independence and self-determination and to govern themselves. History has shown that people will continue to struggle and fight for that right, and you know, they very rarely give up. So no matter how much they bomb the people of Yemen, it's not going to work. And we can't solve these problems through bloodshed and conflict and bombing people and killing innocent people. This is contrary to Islam. It's contrary to any notion of human rights, and the world just turns a blind eye to it. Because as long as it's not happening in the United States or in Europe, as long as they're not fighting themselves, it's okay for the rest of the world. That's how I see it.
Okay, I appreciate your contribution and comments. So we have Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law with Princeton University, joined us out of Yale Kavik, and Jahangir Mohammed, Director of the Center for Muslim Affairs from Manchester. Welcome back. Let's move on to the rest of this broadcast. The World Health Organization is warning of a false sense of security in Europe, as most of the countries there are seeing a fall in COVID-19 cases and deaths. The WHO's Europe director noted that a majority of European countries remain vulnerable to increasing outbreaks of new variants. Hans Kluge said that vaccines are essential, but as of now, they aren't sufficient to control the pandemic. He cautioned against rash decisions by countries contemplating easing restrictions. He also renewed the call for an equitable distribution of vaccines to include poorer nations. He warned that an unfair access to the jabs can backfire. Across WHO's European region, 38 countries have recorded cases linked to the variant first discovered in Britain, and 19 nations recorded cases from the South African variant. Iran has reported 65 new fatalities from the novel coronavirus, and that raises the death toll to 58,000. The health ministry says that 7,400 new infections were registered in the past day, and that brings the country's tally to more than 1.4 million. More than 1.2 million people have also recovered from the respiratory disease. Iran tightened up its restrictions since last November, and chooses the country to launch its COVID-19 vaccination campaign, starting with frontline medical workers. According to health officials, 16 million people will receive two doses of vaccines in four phases within a year. Now let's take a look at the U.S. The country remains the world's worst hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. Number of infections there surpassing 27.2 million. The country has also logged more than 471,000 deaths. That according to the latest data by Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. accounts for some 25% of global COVID infections and 28% of deaths. It continues to witness a steep rise in cases and fatalities despite a vaccination drive underway. According to a recent Gallup survey, some two-thirds of Americans aren't satisfied with the vaccine rollout and distribution in the country. As part of the battle against the coronavirus pandemic, Venezuela has purchased 10 million Russian vaccines. Despite facing U.S. sanctions, Venezuela is continuing its battle against the deadly virus with the aid of its allies. Jesus Silva reports.
President Nicolas Maduro has announced that Sputnik V vaccines are on their way to Venezuela this week in order to shore up the country's ongoing fight against the coronavirus outbreak. Within the framework of a bilateral agreement between Venezuela and Russia, Maduro has signed a contract with Russia to purchase 10 million doses of Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccines. The Venezuelan head of state has thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin for providing the medical resources to tackle the virus outbreak. Furthermore, Maduro has stressed that his administration will ensure that every person in the country will be vaccinated. In this light, Venezuelan officials have praised the alliance between Caracas and Moscow.
Although U.S. sanctions impede Venezuela's purchase of vaccines from abroad, Russia has bravely disregarded such sanctions and sold them to our nation.
But some opposition figures have criticized the bilateral deal.
Maduro's relation with Putin is not seen positively by the U.S., so he's deliberately stirring conflict with Washington.
Nonetheless, legal experts have a totally different view.
Maduro and Putin are correctly saving lives with vaccines. For them, health is more important than U.S. foreign policy.
Despite the economic difficulties prompted by the U.S. blockade, the Venezuelan government has made great financial efforts to purchase millions of Russian vaccines in hopes of containing the ongoing COVID outbreak that has rocked the whole Latin American region. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A British public health agency has warned that a UK coronavirus variant is likely to sweep the whole world.
What's really affected us at the moment is transmissibility, because the new variant has swept the country, is going to sweep the world in all probability. In the future, I think the key is going to be if something is particularly problematic with vaccines. And I think that we're going to be able to duck and dive around that to get our vaccines tweaked and get them rolled out, getting boosters.
Well, Sharon Peacock says that vaccines are effective against the new strain, but that mutations could potentially undermine the shots. She says that health agencies can stop worrying about it once they get on the top of the virus or it mutates itself. There are three major known COVID-19 variants that are worrying the scientists. They're the South African variant, the UK or Kent variant, and the Brazilian one. The British variant is more infectious, but not necessarily deadlier than the others. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Line.
residents of Homsa al-Falqa have repeatedly had their homes in the Jordan Valley destroyed by Israeli regime forces, says Sa'atha Hamad, a journalist, in an article published under the heading, Israeli regime village demolition leaves Palestinian families desperate and homeless. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Aisha Abu Awad, 57, sat in front of a demolished tent that once constituted her family's home in the Palestinian community of Homsa al-Falqa. With practically no shelter from the winter weather, she held tightly to her youngest granddaughter, 3-month-old Manar, who is also the youngest newborn in the community. As the cold wind intensified and storms approached, the pair could do nothing but wait for a new tent to be erected. On February 1st, the Zionist regime army demolished and confiscated a number of homes and tents in the Bedouin community, which lies in the occupied West Bank's northern Jordan Valley. The army completed the demolition process on February 3rd, following a period of 3 days in which they demolished 70 shelters and tents, some of which were homes and some used for livestock, which locals depend on as their main livelihood. 11 Palestinian families, consisting of close to 80 individuals, including more than 40 children, were displaced, and they no longer have a home or safe shelter this winter. It is not the first time the army has demolished Homsa al-Falqa. The entire community was knocked down as recently as November 2020. The residents rejected the army's attempts to forcibly deport them and rebuild their homes. The army also regularly raids the area under the pretext of military exercises and temporarily displaces the residents for several days. So far, the families have been evacuated 11 times. Aisha, who moves around with difficulty, suffers from back pain that intensifies in the cold. The community has become rubble. The Israeli regime army came and destroyed all of our homes and tents, Aisha told reporters. We are now in the open between the ground and the sky. She is a mother of 4 children and 8 grandchildren. The eldest of the newest generation, Amid, has not yet turned 6, while the youngest are Manar and 7-month-old Hadil. Running around their demolished homes, children played and tried to collect their toys from underneath the wreckage. Aisha observed them intently and called on them every once in a while to check that they are okay. I fear greatly for these children. We are unable to provide them with safety today, or even the ability to protect them from the cold, she said. We have no alternative but to remain here on our land. They will continue to demolish, and we will continue to build and remain steadfast here. Thunder began to light up the sky over the demolished community. Minutes later, the wind intensified and the first raindrops began to fall. The children continued to play, unaware of the difficult night that lay ahead for themselves and their families. Amal Abu Kabash, 25, paced around to collect some blankets and hide them under the destroyed tent. They're trying to make life difficult for us and to surround us from all sides. Life here has become almost impossible. Despite all that, we continue to remain here, he told reporters. Walking among the destroyed tents, 52-year-old Muhammad Abu Awad appeared tired, deeply sad and angry. My family of 18 is out in the open today, he said. There is no longer a tent to protect us from the cold and to bring us together. Since the demolition, the Israeli regime army has set up roadblocks in the vicinity of Homsa al-Falqa,
preventing water tanks and tents from reaching us, and confiscating the belongings we try to bring in. He said that the Israeli regime intended to make Humsa al-Faqa, which extends over 60,000 dunams, that is 60 square kilometers, an area completely empty of Palestinian residents, in order to build settlements on it. On February 4th, a Palestinian Authority delegation headed by Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad al-Shatayeh and a number of diplomats and international human rights institutions visited to Humsa al-Faqa as a form of solidarity. A group of the Israeli regime army and intelligence vehicles closely monitored the event. A military checkpoint was set up at the entrance to the community, and all vehicles entering the area were subjected to searches. Our hope is that this solidarity will be real and will not end today, and that it will turn into an act that supports our presence here, not just a show before the media's cameras, said Abu Awad. He pointed out that the community's location in a remote and marginalized area meant that the army could carry out its policies against them quietly. The presence of others around us protects us and draws attention to what is happening to us here, and we hope that this will be a deterrent to the Israeli regime army and expose its actions to the world, he said. Aisha is less optimistic. Everyone will leave, and we will remain alone facing this reality each day and fighting it alone, she said. Murad Eshtawi, head of the Wall and Settlement Resistance Committee office in Northern West Bank, told reporters that the Zionist regime army had demolished several tents that were rebuilt by a group of activists who have been present with the community since February 1st for support. The army also confiscated 9 vehicles belonging to activists and residents as a way to deter them. Eshtabi emphasized that the continuous demolition of Humsa al-Faqa was not merely a punitive act that the Zionist regime army had only just carried out, but rather a process of forcible displacement that seeks to empty the area of the Palestinians. Today, the Zionist regime army is targeting Humsa al-Faqa, but this policy will also affect the rest of the Palestinian villages and communities in the Jordan Valley, as the Israeli regime seeks to annex the area, which constitutes a third of the West Bank and includes its most fertile lands.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Samura ibn Jundab, a companion of the Prophet who is not a very good person. He's got history. During the time of the Prophet, he did some very wrong things. But Muawiyah sent a message to this individual telling him that I will pay you 700,000 dinar or dirham, silver or gold coins, that you say, I heard the Prophet saying the verse of the Quran that says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. Of the people, there are those that when they speak of the dunya, they amaze you, they astonish you. وَهُوَ أَلَدُّ الْخِصَامِ at the end of the verse, it says, they are actually the worst of the foes, the enemies. I want you to say that you heard the Prophet saying, this is Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ali ibn Abi Talib was known for his speeches, for his khutab, about the dunya, about the nature of this material realm, and it is astonishing, obviously. Muawiyah wanted to take that element away from Amir al-Mu'mineen so that people stop when they hear these great words, these great sermons from Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they start viewing him as such a great person. He's trying to use this to make people think that this is all hypocrisy. Ali ibn Abi Talib is actually alad bil khisam, al-ayadu billah. On the other hand, a verse that follows, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ, of the people, there are those that give their souls, their themselves, their lives, in order to achieve Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's pleasure. This is definitely about Amir al-Mu'min. Muawiyah says, Samura, I want you to say this. I heard the Prophet say this is about Ibn Muljim. Reverse things. Friday sermons being done on Wednesday. And a whole bunch of other things. Changing Islam. Muawiyah has stated this. Hearing Ashhadu anna Muhammad al-Rasulullah, I wish I could take this out. I don't want to hear that name. I don't want to hear. That's not how much hatred they had towards the Prophet. There's a movement. There's various reasons for that. One of the major reasons for this is the following. What was it that removed the Umayyads, Abu Sufyan, from power in Mecca? Was Islam. What was it that if it was in place, it wouldn't have allowed Muawiyah to be, forget about Khalifa, even the governor of Sham, which is not even one of the larger provinces of the Muslim Empire? Sham was not even one of the largest at the time. Amir al-Mu'minin, as soon as he came in, he was put in by others. That was not according to Islamic teachings. As soon as he came in, he's out. What is it that would not allow Muawiyah to even be the governor? Islam. If Islam is preached, no Muslim would allow that. What religion is it that says, we will not pledge allegiance to Yazid, even if we are slaughtered? Islam. Follow that teaching, if they follow what the Quran actually says, the Umayyads can never be in power. So they're going to change it. These are all Muslims. They all believe in God. They have to do something about it, because if you really believe in God and you go by His teachings, then you can't allow this guy to be your ruler. And no tyrant would be able to rule based on. And if people believe in Islam, and they practice Islam, and they sacrifice based on what Islam says, and they become fearless of the wrath of the government because of Islam, then tyrants will not have the ability to rule anymore. So they're going to change that Islam. Try pushing away from that. They will give you a misinterpretation of what these verses are. Jahidil kuffara wal munafiqeen, the Quran says. Find the munafiqeen, find the kuffar, jahid, fight them. This Quran, when it says jahidil kuffara wal munafiqeen, Muawiyah is a munafiq. Any tyrant, if they portray themselves as a Muslim, the Al Saud family, Al Khalifa, the rulers of the United Arab Emirates, all these identify as Muslim. What are they? They're munafiq. Jahid al-kuffara wal munafiqin. They're ruling over thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, depending on which country we're referring to, of Muslims. If these Muslims go by this verse, جاهد الكفار والمنافقين, will remain of Al-Khalifa? Will remain of Al-Saud? They will have to change this religion. They'll have to tell the Muslims, actually, not only are these people not munafiq, they are Khalifatullah. That's what they said. That's what they're saying. What do you think the Saudi family is saying? They say, we are Muslim. We are the representatives of Islam. You have to give bay'ah based on your religion. That's what they're saying. That's what they're preaching. They had to create, like what we see. MBS is clear. This guy is bringing in people that this minbar should not be a place to mention them in their occupation. Bring them to a Muslim country, having open, public program sessions. Sins are committed publicly. They don't care. Well, you say, okay, so they're not practicing Islam. How can they be Khalifatullah? Well, they have to make a rule. Anyone who takes government by power, they are Khalifa. That rule is there in the fiqh that they follow. Well, it's a fabrication. That's not what Allah says. Allah says, إِنَّمَا وَلِيُّكُمُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ أَطِيعُوا اللَّهُ وَأَطِيعُوا الرَّسُولُ وَأُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. They have to be of you. Is this behavior of you? Is it of the mu'mineen? Of Islam? Not أُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. This is a munafiq. The Quran says, بَشِّرِ الْمُنَافِقِينَ بَأَنَّ لَهُمْ عَذَابًا أَلِيمًا الَّذِينَ يَتَّخِذُونَ الْكَافِرِينَ أَوْلِيَاءً مِنْ دُونِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Clear sign of a munafiq is to take kuffar as awliya. What's the Al-Saud family doing? When the Bahraini revolution occurred, where did they go? Al-Khalifa, where did they go? They went to the British. They went to the Saudi. Like, look, we're goners. You guys better help us. Kuffar came in and supplied them, gave them support, gave them the green light. Saudi troops came in. The mu'mineen are there. They rejected the wilaya of the mu'mineen. They went to the wilaya of the kuffar, munafiqeen. If the believers in Bahrain want to apply the rulings of Islam, Al-Khalifa cannot rule. In Kuwait, the rulers cannot rule. In the UAE, they cannot rule. Al-Saud cannot rule. They'll be like Yemen. They'll be like Iraq. They'll be like other countries that moving in that direction or have moved in that direction. So Islam has to be implemented. We will choose people that we can identify as believers, as mu'mineen, and we want the kuffar to leave our country. The recent law that was passed in the Iraqi parliament, leave. We don't want these troops in this country. Tyrants don't like this. They don't like Islam. Because if you go by Islam, this is what's going to happen. They're not going to be able to. Islam says, fight them. If you're killed, you're a shaheed. That culture starts picking up as it is in the Muslim world. In Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. Yeah. محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A geochemical study of sediments suggests that during recent glacial periods, the Arctic Ocean was completely isolated from the world ocean, with fresh water filling the basin for thousands of years. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sharon Hoffman, researcher. This article is published under the heading, "The Arctic Ocean Might Have Been Filled with Fresh Water During Ice Ages." Stay tuned for the details, please. The Arctic region is undergoing rapid climatic and environmental change, so knowledge of its past variability is crucial for understanding modern trends and predicting future ones. Ancient climate conditions and ocean behavior are often reconstructed by analyzing marine sediments. But Arctic sediments can be difficult to interpret, and much is still unknown about how the Arctic Ocean changed during specific glacial and interglacial periods over the past few million years. Writing in Nature, Gubert et al. Report analysis of an isotope of element thorium in sea floor sediments, which suggests that the Arctic Ocean swung between being filled with salt water and fresh water during periods of the two most recent glacials. The authors base their argument on records of thorium-230 produced from the decay of dissolved uranium that is naturally present in seawater. Thorium is highly insoluble and sticks to solid particles such as dust grains or biological material, which sink to the seafloor and become buried in sediments. Thorium that derives from water column in this way is known as excess thorium-230. It is typically present in sediments deposited during the past 450,000 years and is often measured to determine sediment deposition rates. Gibbert and colleagues' innovation is instead to use these measurements to reconstruct how much thorium-230 was produced in the Arctic Ocean over the time, and thereby to determine how the salinity has changed. The authors examined sediment cores from across the Arctic and Nordic seas and found that thorium-230 is absent in several layers of sediment deposited during the past 200,000 years. The cores suggest that no thorium-230 was produced in the water above the study sites between about 150,000 and 131,000 years ago, during the next to the last glacial. 70,000 and 62,000 years ago, during early parts of the last glacial, and perhaps even as recently as about 15,000 years ago, at the end of the last glacial. Thank you.
PM230 produced in seawater is removed so rapidly by sinking particles that its net horizontal transport across the ocean is typically low, even in the particle-poor Arctic. The intervals of absent thorium-230 in the sediment cores therefore imply that the uranium concentration was low to non-existent in the water above the study sites when those sediments were deposited. This in turn implies that the entire water column was essentially fresh down to the sea floor. There were no dissolved salts of any type. Thick ice shelves covered regions of the Arctic during previous glacials. Gibert et al. Posit that such ice shelves could have extended into the Nordic seas, possibly grounding on the Greenland-Scotland Ridge, the tall underwater feature that separates the Nordic seas from the rest of the Atlantic basin. The ice shelves might, in effect, have dammed the Arctic and Nordic seas, isolating them from salt inflows from the Atlantic. The low sea levels at that time blocked the exchange of water with the Pacific Ocean through the Bering Strait. Fresh water from the melting land ice and precipitation could therefore have entered and eventually filled the isolated northern basins. An advantage of Gibert and co-workers' thorium-230 method is that, unlike many other techniques used in paleoceanography, no biologically produced material is needed for the analysis. It can therefore be used to probe environments that would have had low to no biological productivity, such as a freshwater Arctic Ocean beneath ice shelves. Indeed, microfossils in the thorium-230 free sediment layers are absent or extremely rare, or are derived from older deposits rather than being contemporaneous with the thorium-230 minima. This new interpretation of thorium-230 might also provide an intriguing means of reconciling contrasting results previously obtained from different methods of estimating past sea levels. The relative abundances of oxygen isotopes in global seawaters are recorded in microfossils and in part reflect the sequestration of evaporated ocean water into ice sheets or other freshwater reservoirs, which can affect sea level. For certain times during recent ice ages, sea level records obtained from isotopic analyses of microfossils are inconsistent with records derived from corals. Gibert et al. Suggests that these inconsistencies could be explained by the proposed storage of large volumes of fresh water in the Arctic Ocean. Various complications in the analysis will no doubt raise questions. Arctic sediments are notoriously hard to date owing to the lack of microfossils and because sedimentation rates varied. It is therefore uncertain whether the thorium-230 deficient intervals in the cores were produced at exactly the same times at all sites across the ocean basins. Moreover, the authors had to correct their data to account for 230 that was produced from uranium decay in sediment grains rather than in the water columns, and this contributed to the uncertainty in measured thorium-230. These corrections become proportionally more important for older sediments because thorium-230 itself decays away. Thorium decay also limits the time span over which the method can be used to investigate Arctic salinity. Finally, no freshwater fauna have been identified in the sediments concerned, so direct evidence of freshwater intrusion into deep Arctic basins remains to be found. However, the various absences of thorium-230 of microfossils and biological productivity and of elements such as sulfur, which partly derive from salinity in marine sediments, suggest exciting avenues for future research. Computational modeling of Arctic ocean circulation and ice sheet behavior will be needed to determine realistic estimates of the circulation and freshwater runoff from land that could produce the basin filled with fresh water. Further geochemical and fossil analysis might help to support or challenge the assertion that the Arctic Ocean could have been fresh. Gilbert and colleagues' innovative use of thorium-230 might spare a re-evaluation of what is possible in the Arctic Ocean and of how dramatically this region can change.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
Ultimately, the enemies want to create and keep in power a government that is weak and obedient, a government that does not have enough power, a government that would not stand up against America. These are the goals. All these measures and all these courses of actions have failed so far. They have been unsuccessful so far. Of course, they have made a lot of efforts. They have adopted various courses of action, and I'll mention some of them in my speech today. The enemies did not spare any effort. but they were not successful because the people were vigilant. We have good elites in our society. We have good people. We have good government officials. Thankfully, the enemy has not been able to realize its goals so far. The revolution has continued its path and has moved forward. What happened during the revolution? Notice that these are the points. The revolution that took place in Iran caused some changes which were fundamental in terms of their death.
Allah, Allah.
It is on the basis of such changes that one can push society forward and make far-reaching changes. These essential pillars were firmly built. I would like to mention a few of the changes that were made. Of course, everybody knows these things. We all know them. They are right in front of our eyes. But Allah the Exalted points out the existence of the sun in the Holy Quran. I swear by the sun and its brilliance. The Holy Quran, chapter 91, verse 1. The sun is in front of our eyes, but Allah the Exalted swears by the sun in order to attract our attention to this obvious and huge entity. In the same way, we have to pay attention to the great phenomena that surrounds us. Therefore, the purpose of pointing out these things is to turn our attention to them. First of all, before the revolution, the government which was ruling over our country was deeply opposed to Islam. They were not very strict about Islamic appearances, but they were after destroying the roots and the essence of Islamic faith of the people.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.